I'm Aaron Reeves. I'm from the University of Oxford. I'm a postdoctoral researcher there, and the work that I do primarily is looking at the relationship between politics, economics, and society, and looking at specifically how those three things impact health. And so today I'm going to talk about the impact of the recession and austerity on health specifically. And the evidence is quite clear that recessions harm health, but austerity can exacerbate the impact of the recession. So we find that suicide rates have gone up, people with HIV and AIDS have gone up in some countries. We see that mental health generally is deteriorating and that people are struggling to access healthcare that they desperately need. But we're also seeing that austerity is making that worse, that it's actually hurting the most vulnerable by removing necessary support and protection from the economic shock of the Great Recession. And so today I'm trying to make the case that austerity harms health, but that that is a choice that we make and that we could change how our governments respond to the recession and recessions in the future. Thank you, first of all, for the invitation to come and speak on what I consider to be a really timely and important topic. I very much appreciate the help being able to get here today and the people that have organised that. So in terms of thinking about this question, I want to make just a couple of comments before I start. I won't, sadly, be talking too much about the work that we're doing with Dimitrik around natural experiments. Perhaps another time might make that available to us. But to deal primarily with this issue around the economic crisis, austerity, and health. A lot of the work that we do is centered around trying to understand the relationship between political, economic, and social factors, and the way in which those intersect in impinging upon the lives and health of populations. A lot of what we do is concerned with across Europe variation and changes. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about today will be at that level. It'll be at the aggregate level. And so I hope that in talking about this, it will provoke conversation, questions about how relevant is this for the work that you do in your respective areas. Also, much of the research that I'm going to share with you is based on work that we have done as a group. There are people that are working in this space who have done excellent work, and I won't talk about the stuff that they've done, not because it's not great, but simply because I suppose my comparative advantage is to talk about the things that I know best. But with that, I also just want to acknowledge a couple of key colleagues, Sanjay Basu, Martin McKee, and David Stuckler, who have been at the forefront in many ways of looking at these issues across Europe and also other regions of the world. So to start, I want to talk about three events or stories. The first is a very tragic story from Greece, the end of last year. A young 13-year-old girl died from inhaling fumes from a makeshift oven. Her mother couldn't afford to pay the electricity, and so had made this makeshift stove both to cook and heat the home, and had burned wood and various other fuels in there. And during the night, her daughter had passed out and then subsequently died. In Italy, this is a picture of Anne-Marie and Romeo Dionisi. Romeo was unemployed and unable to find new work. They were claiming his wife's pension, but was part of the Italian government's austerity measures had extended the age at which Romeo would be able to claim his pension. Faced with the prospect of living on just Anne-Marie's pension, they both decided to take their own lives. And so I think these stories do two important things. One is they highlight that when we're talking about some of these kind of big data, big numbers, that there are really people behind this. And I think it's really critical to remember that there are lives at stake when we talk about some of these issues. But the second reason I want to bring this up, because I want to contrast them with something that David Cameron said just a few months ago. in November in the Lord Mayor's House, he talked about a new economic reality and said that the times have changed in which governments are not going to be able anymore to spend on social welfare and social protection in the way that they have in the past. And that he advocated a form of permanent austerity, that we weren't going to be able to return to the situation that we've had under previous governments. And I mention this because missing in this debate, at least as I see it, is a discussion of the health effects of austerity and the crisis. Now, I think it's reasonable for David Cameron and the coalition government to not necessarily use these anecdotes that I've shared with you, sad and tragic though they may be, as the basis for their policies. But the question that I and my colleagues are trying to answer in part is there evidence of the harm of austerity? And so that kind of introduction aside, I want to try and address three big questions. The first is to look at changes in health expenditure and social protection expenditure by governments across Europe. So there have been some who have said, particularly from the UK, said that austerity is just really a watchword. It's not actually happening. It's not really being major changes in the level of spending. And in fact, some people have advocated that austerity should have been harder and faster than it has. So I want to kind of look at that issue and consider some of the implications of that. I want to also consider, what is the impact of the economic crisis on health? Is there any evidence that it's having a negative or a positive effect? People have made arguments in both directions. And then finally, I want to draw some lessons from this in terms of thinking about how to protect health systems and also how to protect the health of populations. So firstly, kind of patterns of stimulus austerity. So what are the changes that we've seen? So this is a heat map. So I'm just going to give you a moment. I know there's a lot of data here. I just want to kind of, I think this is a good way of representing some of the changes. So this is changes in government expenditure between 2009 and 2011 across Europe. This is adjusted for inflation and purchasing power, and it's per capita, so per person. And what we have down the left-hand side, the left kind of vertical axis, are the different sectors of government spending. So we have economic affairs, spending on health, defence, education, etc. Along the bottom, we have the different countries, and they're ordered. So on your left, we have the countries that have reduced government spending the most across this period. And on the your right, we have those that have increased it the most. And Ireland here is a little bit of an outlier. We can talk about perhaps why for various reasons, but it's primarily driven by the dark blue economic affairs square at the top. But nevertheless, so actually what we can see is that broadly speaking, when we take this high-level view, countries have made kind of varied decisions about where they have decided to make changes, both in terms of implementing austerity and also in investing additional government funds, expenditure. But if we look at this health line, so if we follow that across, we can see a number of countries have dark red squares. So these are countries that have actually reduced spending by substantial amounts in this period. And Greece is an example that is perhaps somewhat familiar to us. We know that there has been radical changes there over this period. So what do we know about healthcare austerity in Greece? The first thing we know is that they tried to do three things. The first is that they wanted to reduce public spending on pharmaceuticals and drugs. They felt that they were spending too much on sicknesses and illnesses that didn't necessarily require this type of spending. They wanted to decrease the workforce, and they also wanted to change the way in which some of those pharmaceuticals and other medical products had been purchased. So what are some of the implications? We can see that if we look at Greece just particularly, this is just countries that have reduced spending across Europe, a lot of the reduction for Greece came in medical products. And one of the implications of that was that Greece reduced the amount of spending on needle exchange programs. And so in Greece, there has been a rise in the number of people with HIV and AIDS. And this has been rather dramatic over the last couple of years. And it's almost been it's located almost solely in a group of people, the injecting drug users. So these are people who may have been affected by an inability to access clean needles, but there's also some other government policies which have made getting needles to these people more difficult. So it's not just that they've kind of removed spending on that, but seems to have an impact. But this is one kind of potential association that we're seeing that is very, very concerning. Another is unmet medical needs. So we have survey data from Greece that asks people, you know, is there a kind of medical need that you have not been able to meet recently? Have you not gone to the doctor for a particular reason? And we see that among all people between 2007 and 2011, there's been a 50% increase in the number of people that are saying, yes, I have an unmet medical need. That is even higher among the elderly, and somewhat surprisingly, is very, very high, almost double in urban areas. And part of the reason for this is this reduction of access to services that the government have made in some of these urban areas, and seems to be particularly affecting the elderly, in that their mobility, even though it's in an urban area, isn't necessarily able to get to the now nearest healthcare point. But what are the reasons? The same survey data asks why do you have these unmet medical needs? 43% said they could not afford it. But a huge amount of people, 184% increase, said that it was too far to travel. So one question that I think this raises is this a concern? Should we be worried that the medical needs that people themselves say that they need and that they're not getting, is that a worry? Maybe they're just not getting things they need but aren't really that important to them. Previous data suggests that when people miss healthcare, so when they spend their money potentially on something else, as they would in Greece need to do, they tend to miss both the significant and non-significant. That is, there seems to be no real relation around the types of choices, the types of healthcare that people do not access. So yes, this is going to be harming some people's long-term health because they're not getting the care that they need, because either they can't afford it, because it's too far away, because they need to pay co-payments for the pharmaceuticals that they might need. So Greece is perhaps an unusual case and one that has some major challenges. But we also know that social protection is another area where government spending has been reduced in some areas. So social protection includes things like social welfare, unemployment benefits, housing, these types of traditional government-sponsored programs in which they provide support for some of the most vulnerable people in society. And again, if we look across this range of countries, we see that there's a great deal of variation. Now, what's particularly interesting about this trend is due to something called the automatic stabilizer. So this is kind of an economic term that during recessions, because people become unemployed, social protection spending usually goes up. There's more people that require more help from the state, and therefore spending on social protection should be blue across the board during a recession. So in those areas that we see that it's red, that's a reduction not only against the trend of what we would expect. So these are actually some quite drastic changes in spending in these areas. So what we can do is kind of explode that out, kind of drill down, if you like, and look at the different types of social protection spending. So we have things like sickness and disability, family, unemployment, housing. And again, these are ordered from top to bottom in the areas across Europe that have received the greatest reductions. So what we're saying is that broadly, across Europe, the area with the greatest reduction in social protection spending is sickness and disability. Then it's income for low-income families, and then it's unemployment. So some of the most vulnerable people in our societies across Europe are actually feeling the brunt of these types of austerity policies when applied to social protection. And the UK is not an exception to that rule, has dark red squares for each of those three. So again, what evidence is there that these changes are being implemented? What does it mean for people? So this is the trend in rising severe material deprivation in the UK using 2007 as the baseline. So this is the percentage change. And what's particularly interesting, I think, here is that there is a slight rise during the recession, but actually there's kind of somewhat of a recovery to a certain extent in 2009, but actually a dramatic rise after 2010. We see a somewhat similar trend in the number of people who are unable to keep their house warm. Again, the recession definitely had an impact in limiting the ability of people to heat their homes, but it seems that that's begun to rise again as some of the austerity measures have begun to get underway. The same applies to people that are unable to make ends meet. These trends are particularly concerning because we know what happens when people are unable to keep their houses warm. We have good evidence around what happens when people are experiencing material deprivation on their long-term health. So when we look just at England, and we look at where these cuts are happening, we have along the bottom here a measure of deprivation. This is premature mortality. These colleagues from the University of Liverpool. And so each of these dots are a local authority in England. And we have the cut per head in those local authorities. And so broadly speaking, it's those areas that are already the most deprived, those areas that already suffer from health inequalities, that are experiencing the greatest reductions in their budgets for the local authorities. And this seems somewhat counterintuitive to me, that actually we should be perhaps protecting or be more concerned about some of these populations. If we look at changes in local authority expenditure across this period and changes in unemployment, there's again a fairly strong correlation, this is by region, between changes in cuts in local authority expenditure when they go up, which is across, that increase in unemployment goes up as well. There are 500,000 public sector unemployment jobs that were lost across this period. Again, this is England. 35% of those were in the north, and the suicide rate also went up by 20%. And actually, Jamie Pierce, who works in this area, has shown that London was the only place, when extending this period a little bit longer past 2011, London was the only place to have experienced a net gain in public sector employment, whereas all other regions have experienced declines. So this kind of changes, implementing kind of making people redundant that were in public sector employment, is actually going to harm those areas that relied on that the greatest. And we know that places in the north of England and Scotland rely heavily on public sector employment. This is a measure of homelessness. It's, again, using the end of 2009 as the baseline here. We see that even during the recession, the number of people who were homeless or were registered as homeless, this isn't counting people that applied to receive the status of being homeless. This is actually the number of people that were, by their local authorities, determined to be homeless. That actually that declines and then begins to increase. With the coalition government came into power around here, and certainly the recession is having some impact here on the beginning, but this kind of general trend in the number of people who are perhaps unable to afford the housing where they live, or again, various changes in the way that caps were implemented for allowances for housing benefit are perhaps driving some of these changes as well over time. In terms of disability, and incapacity benefit, recent changes to the way in which those services are delivered, and these are actually the government's estimates, the impact assessments that they have to carry out, have shown that around 250,000 people will experience reduced payments of up to around £4,000 a year. 150,000 of those are currently living in poverty, and these changes will push an extra 50,000 into poverty, and this is across the UK. These are substantial changes, substantial sums of money that will have a drastic impact on people that already suffer from poor health in their communities. And Scotland is no exception. A recent report on welfare reform has shown that the most deprived regions here have received the largest cuts. In Glasgow, this is per working adult. The average level of the change is around £650 per year per working adult. In terms of incapacity benefit in Scotland, the estimate is around 140,000 people will be affected by changes, and that they will experience reductions up to around £3,000 per year. For tax credits, an even larger number, around 350,000, will experience reductions around £800 a year. And those on housing benefits, so this isn't including the bedroom tax, this is housing benefit changes other than that, around, again, 80,000 people with a reduction of around £1,000. Now, these are concerning because, as I said earlier, we have good evidence around what poverty does to health, the way it exacerbates health inequalities. And so these changes are actually only going to make worse the situations that we face for some of the most vulnerable people in our societies. But specifically, what has the recession done in terms of health? I think most of the data that I've shared up to this point is looking at some of what we know. We don't have great evidence on the impact, the direct effect of some of these policies, because the data isn't necessarily there yet. In my mind, it's a scandal of ignorance, really, that we can have up-to-the-minute economic data, but we don't. The health data that we need takes sometimes years to get access to. And we are waiting still to try and really assess the impact of what's happened. But we do know some things. And some of what we know about the impact of the recession and the crisis has come from previous recessions, so I'll talk a little bit about that. But some of it also comes from data that we have right now. So, and maybe it's fitting that I mention this in this particular building, but the economic crisis, when there are mass rises in unemployment, so when unemployment goes up radically inside a year, so a 3% rise, we know that alcohol abuse tends to go up rapidly as well. So this is looking at previous recessions across Europe. But what's particularly concerning about this most recent recession is that this is looking at this is data from the US, but we see a similar trend in the UK, is that when we look at the aggregate level, the actual level of alcohol consumption has declined slightly. But when we're able to kind of break that apart, we see two distinct groups. There are those, the kind of dashed line, whose alcohol consumption has actually declined during this period in the US, but then risen steadily again. But then there are people who were heavy drinkers before the recession, and that actually the recession has exacerbated the amount that they drink. So it's made it worse. So alcohol abuse has gone up for this group of people, even though the aggregate trend shows that it's perhaps going slightly downward. And again, as I said, we see this kind of trend in Europe as well. So what this says is that it's not necessarily about looking at the broad level. We need to focus on those who are perhaps most at risk of alcohol abuse as to the impact of the recession on these people. Another area where there's good evidence around the economic crisis is traffic accidents. And actually, transport accidents tend to decline during the recessions. So this is one area where recessions have actually been positive for health, generally speaking, across Europe. So again, we see a kind of a 1.5% decline in this change of transport accidents. And there are some mechanisms hypothesized for why that may be. People maybe who are struggling, perhaps financially, might drive less, they might pay public transport more. And so this is the kind of general trend across Europe. We see this. Just beyond this, this goes up to 2010. In 2011, the UK had a rise in traffic accidents. And it's one of the few that we've seen for a very long period of time now. And it's there's still to be seen whether that continues. But it's a concerning piece of evidence because it's counterintuitive to what some of what we would have expected at this point. And there are maybe some reasons why, and you might have some ideas too. But this is one of the areas where there's perhaps a positive effect. Another that's well known is suicide. Again, when we experience rapid rises in unemployment in previous recessions, suicide tends to go up. And this tends to goes up greatest in those who are of working age. So this is the most recent period. So we have here data from 2000 to 2011, and we can see that the dashed line is the suicide rate, the solid line is the unemployment rate. So roughly speaking, as unemployment has begun to rise, so too has the suicide rate. But this association, as I said, has been well documented, well back and since Emil Durkheim and one of the founding fathers of sociology has looked at this. But what we're interested in perhaps is this association inevitable? So previous research has suggested that active labour market programmes may be one mitigating factor. So active labour market programmes are schemes that provide support for people who are potentially going to become unemployed or who are in fact unemployed. And this might be in the form of income replacement, for example, like unemployment benefit, but it also provides various kinds of support in terms of job training, may actually pay to keep them in work longer so that the company doesn't make them redundant, keeps them in employment, but also provides other levels of support that over and above what we'd expect in the job centre, for instance, in the UK. So when we have looked across Europe and thought about these active labour market programmes, one of the things we wanted to do is, okay, what's the impact of this, the recession on suicides against this trend? We see a downward trajectory. And in some circles, and I've heard this discussed in the European Commission, for example, they'll say, but this is only a small number of people. You know, we can't do much about this. It's not a huge problem. We need to be concerned about the bigger problem of the debt, for example. But we estimate that there's been around 8,000 excess suicides across Europe, 15,000 across Europe and North America. So this is a substantial, large number of people. And so what we did was said, okay, we found in previous recessions that active labour market programmes can mitigate some of that effect. And what we did was, in this recession, compared those who spend more than the kind of median on active labour market programmes and those on the right here that spend less than the median on these active labour market programmes. So the change in unemployment, this solid black line, is fairly consistent in both regions. That actually unemployment has risen in both sets of areas. But the change in the suicide rate is very different. This dashed line shows that in areas where there's high levels of investment in active labour market programmes, the suicide rate has maybe risen very, very slightly and then declined, or in those areas where there's been low investment, shows that that's actually risen quite rapidly across this period. So this is some of the evidence around that we have around the impact of the recession on health. But there's also some, I think, lessons for the future. And so I want to present here, again, kind of very high level, some of the work that we've been doing around what are the kind of, in terms of the big debates that have been happening around austerity and the economic crisis, what can we as social scientists say to those issues? So the first is this question. Why have some countries cut their healthcare budgets? And there are a number of different explanations for why this might have happened. The first is the debt crisis. So a member of the European Commission, the head of the European Commission for the economics, has said that, kind of citing the famous Reinhardt and Rogoff study, that says when public debt levels rise above 90%, they tend to have a negative impact on economic growth. Not only was that study subsequently shown to be incorrect, but actually a more recent IMF paper has found that this isn't true at all either. But anyway, this is maybe one of the concerns, that countries were worried, under the recommendations of the IMF and also the European Commission, that their debt was too high, they need to bring it down. So is the level of debt one of the factors that drive in healthcare changes? Is it political ideology? Some people have said that, you know, parties on the right potentially are more likely to make those types of reductions than parties on the left, for example. We try to look at that. But there's also a depth of the recession argument, the kind of this time it's different hypothesis. This is the view that this recession was so deep and so broad that it was necessary to implement this type of reduction in healthcare and other necessary services. At the same time, there are some that have argued that a visibility. The public health is an area that's actually very difficult to reduce because it's a large portion of the government's budget, and actually people feel very strongly and very passionately, particularly in Europe, about investing in health. So is it an area actually that's very, very difficult to cut? And then finally, we try to look at the role of international financial institutions. So does it matter that the IMF, that you've borrowed money from the IMF, for example? And so if we look at changes in healthcare expenditure against, so this is the horizontal axis here is changes in GDP. So this is kind of like the depth of the recession for each country. And then across the vertical axis, this is the change in healthcare expenditure. I put the United States in red because we don't include them in our analysis, but they're a useful counterpoint. So actually we see, with Greece as the outlier here clearly, but we actually see some variation among the countries around the different levels, the change in health related to the depth of the recession. So I think this raises a question of whether healthcare austerity is a choice. That actually some governments, regardless of the depth of the recession, actually have a choice to make around what type of budgetary decisions they're going to make here. So what we did was we tried to analyze these things, looking at data from 1995 to 2011, looking at government changes over this period. And what we found is that there are some things that don't explain it, the change in healthcare austerity that we see over the most recent recession. And the first is the depth of the recession. Doesn't make a difference. Doesn't explain why some countries reduced health spending and why others increased it. Was it the level of public debt? No. This doesn't make a difference. So we have some countries with really high levels of public debt that are still investing in health, and then we have other countries with very low levels of public debt, the UK actually being one example of that, who implemented reductions in healthcare spending. Is it political ideology? Our results suggest that it's not. That actually the economic ideology of the governing party does not seem to be driving this. So what is? So what we tried to do is to try and visualize this. We found that there were two key factors. One is the role of international financial institutions, and the other is a decision around whether to reduce total government spending. So here we look at the probability. So this is what this estimates, the probability of a country reducing healthcare spending. And if they have not borrowed money from the IMF and have not reduced total government spending, the likelihood of them implementing healthcare austerity is around 15 to 20%. It's really quite low. When countries do reduce government spending as a total, like the UK, but there isn't a loan from the IMF, what we see is that the probability of healthcare goes up to about 0.5. So it's about 50-50. But in countries like Greece, for example, where they've both received aid from the IMF, but also implemented these kind of broad, across-the-board reductions in government spending, the probability of healthcare goes up to around 0.8, 0.9. Very, very high. So in terms of looking at what is trying to influence the types of decisions that our policymakers are making, I think in terms of thinking about the future, these raise some really interesting questions about the decisions that are being made and, as we've seen before, the impact that they may be having. The second key area is a debate around the fiscal multiplier. So this is again a kind of economic term concept, but really what it basically means is the effect of public spending on the economy. So for instance, if government spending goes up by £1 or it goes down by £1, what impact does this have on the economy, on economic growth, on GDP? And the fiscal multiplier tries to estimate the impact of that change in government spending. So if that fiscal multiplier is greater than one, for example, we see increased growth, we see increased GDP. But if it's less than one, we see either slow growth or actually even reduced growth. And this is important because when the recession was starting to get underway, the IMF published a paper which estimated that the fiscal multiplier was about 0.5. Now that's important because governments were then saying, under the recommendation of the European Central Bank and the European Commission, saying, okay, well, if we actually reduce our spending, that will help economic growth in these times. But in 2011, the IMF said that they underestimated the fiscal multiplier. But they underestimated it by quite a bit, because the actual multiplier was 1.7. So this means that actually investing in maintaining government spending would have actually assisted the economic recovery, and that taking money out of the economy actually did it more harm. What my colleagues and I tried to do then was say, all right, we kind of get this big picture that government spending as a whole is maybe good for the economy, even during large recessions like the one that we've just experienced. But what about different sectors of government spending? So what we tried to do was, we said, okay, well, we can see that across the most recent period that when the change in the government spending was largest, change in GDP was fastest. So there's a general sense that countries that kept their spending higher also recovered fastest. But what we, as I said, we tried to do here is look at different sectors of government spending, and this is what we found. So there's a lot going on here, so I'm just going to kind of draw your attention to a couple of key points. At the very, very bottom, the bottom row, this is the estimate of the fiscal multiplier for total government spending. So in our data, we came out with a result around 1.6, which is very, very similar to the IMF estimate. So it's not too far from that. So what that says is that if we put one extra pound into the economy of government spending, then what we get back in GDP is about £1.60, right? That's kind of it's not precisely that, but that's kind of the idea. But what we see is that if we invest in health, that the multiplier is actually much larger. It's around 4. And if we invest in education, it's even larger than that. It's around 8. And if we invest in social protection, it's again positive. It's bigger than 1.6. It's around 2.8, 2.3. So what this result say is two things. One is that not only did the IMF perhaps make a mistake around their guidance to implement austerity, or suggest that countries should implement austerity, but perhaps more than that, the way in which I've already shown that some countries have gone about that in terms of taking money out of health, taking money out of social protection, has actually harmed the economic recovery at the same time that it's harmed those people it was intended to protect. What's particularly striking, I think, is that if we look at the British Social Attitudes Survey, which tracks people, so this is data from 1983 to 2011. We'd have two data for 2012 now. But this shows that the little red bars show the number of people, they interview them almost every year, who want to reduce taxes and spend less on health, education, and social benefits. Those three things that I mentioned that help boost economic growth during times of recession. It never goes above 10%. And yet, if we look at those people that want to keep it the same, actually, we see quite a lot of action here. There's quite a lot of variation over time. But broadly speaking, sometimes a majority of people actually want them to keep them the same. And this is the number of people that want to have them increase. And what I think is particularly striking here is that the number of people that want to reduce spending in these areas rarely ever changes. Most of the variation is between people that want to keep them the same and people that want to increase them. And it's interesting as well that during the 80s, we see one particular trend of kind of declining support for people, we see increasing support for people that want to increase spending. And then during the kind of 2000s, again, it kind of goes back the other way. But what's important, I think, is that there's never been this broad base of public support for austerity, particularly around these three areas. And perhaps if the government had followed the public opinion in these matters, we might be in different shape or perhaps be further out of the recovery than we are right now. The last thing I want to kind of bring out before I get onto some conclusions is an issue around denialism. This is the debate that's usually come in to issues around HIV and AIDS or tobacco. It's a debate that public health professionals are particularly familiar with. It's where people with specific vested interests are refusing to accept the weight of the data that is before them. And it often has these two features. It's kind of a selectivity in how they use data in terms of cherry picking, but also they set up impossible expectations for the evidence that would convince them, and at the same time refuse to fund maybe the studies that would provide the evidence that would convince them. And this trend is something that we have seen from some quarters across Europe. I have some quotes here from a couple of people from Greece, a health minister from Greece, and some other, I haven't necessarily named the people, but you could probably find them online if you wanted. But these tell a story that there is, people saying there's no evidence for the impact of the recession or the impact of the austerity on health. And I think this is a concerning trend, and one of the implications that I have for the future. We need to think very carefully about how we deal with these issues in terms of convincing people that there are very real consequences to these choices. So, broadly speaking, to sum up, what are some conclusions? For me, my reading of the data is that health and social protection austerity have harmed health. Hasn't harmed it across the board, hasn't harmed it for all people, but it has harmed health. And in particular, it seems to have harmed the most vulnerable to the greatest extent. And I think the full extent of that will not be clear to us for a few years yet as the data begins to become more available over time. And finally, it seems that austerity is a choice. It's a choice that is made for a variety of different reasons, but is one that is politically motivated to a certain extent and often has the backing of certain quite powerful international financial institutions. And I think there's good evidence that it's actually harmed the economic recovery. So what's the alternative? Here I'm going to borrow from two colleagues that I mentioned right at the beginning of the presentation, David Duckler and Sanjay Basu. And what they've called for is a new deal for Europe. One of the things that I've heard them say before is that if austerity were a randomized controlled trial, it would have been stopped a long time ago because of the negative impact that it's had on the people who have been exposed to it in Europe. The first thing they say is do no harm. We need to provide social protection for these vulnerable people in our societies. Because if we don't, the evidence is that they will be exposed to these economic variations and they'll be the ones who experience the brunt of it. We need to help people return to work. We need to invest in supporting employment in our communities. And one of the ways that we do that is by investing, by governments investing in providing that through active labour market programmes that I mentioned earlier. But we also need to invest in public health. We need to provide employment, but we also need to provide healthcare for people. And taking away those much needed services will only expose those people, as I mentioned, to these negative effects of the economic crisis. So this brings me back to those kind of three anecdotes, I suppose, that I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation. I hope that the work that's being done in this area by a number of scholars that I mentioned will start to have an impact on the debate around recessions and austerity in the future. That we'll start to think very carefully about some of the decisions that are being made and that will take into consideration the potential health effects of these types of policies. And I suppose the question that could be asked here is, will we continue to balance budgets on the backs of the poor? Thank you very much.